Hello, this thoroughly good classical music podcast features the return of composer Joseph Phibbs, introducing two new compositions which feature as part of the Hatfield Chamber Music Festival on the 29th of September and a double bill of concerts at Wigmore Hall on the 7th of October. One of those concerts is at 11 a.m. in the morning, the other is at 2 p.m. Note that the concert times Joseph mentions in the conversation that follows is incorrect. Also, keep an ear out for some touching personal recollections from Joseph about his composition teacher and composer, Stephen Stuckey, who died a few years ago, and in whose memory Phibbs wrote Elegy, which features as part of the Wigmore Hall programme. Also featuring in that first Wigmore Hall programme is this piece, Night Paths, played here by Hugh Wiggin and pianist Noriko Ogawa. Just a word about the sound, there are one or two irritating blips, actually there's probably a few more than that, and I am sorry. Be rest assured I'll get the sound recordist replaced just as soon as HR guidelines allow. Tell me how things are with you. What have you been up to in the 4 years since we last caught up with each other?
Well, I stopped teaching, which I'd enjoyed very much, but I'd done 10 years of that. That was at the Bursar School. And it's freed up quite a lot more time and energy, more importantly, to compose. So it's basically been writing. Quite a lot of chamber music, which a couple of pieces of which we'll probably talk about today. You know, I think it's more the energy, it's freed up a lot more energy, because you have to give a lot of energy if you're going to teach, you know, in a committed way. So as much as I miss it in some respects, it has given me more time and energy to work.
This may be a difficult question to ask, but does it also indicate sort of a level of confidence or a level of income from composition work? You know, have things shifted such that you now think, okay, I don't need to do the teaching now? I don't know whether those are the kind of thoughts that somebody like you would have.
For most composers, if they're just composing, you never feel a complete security. You know, you're fully aware that things can go up and down, as they indeed usually do. But I think I felt it was a, you know, as I'm approaching 50, it also focuses the mind in terms of what you want to do, I suppose, in the second half of your life, the priorities. And I thought, well, this is a time when I'm going to at least give composing my absolute best shot and try to write the pieces I want to write. And it seemed like the most profitable way, I suppose, to invest my time.
What have you been working on in the meantime then? I mean, I recall one event after the pandemic, or when things were sort of returning to normal, but surely there have been other things.
In the last year, the two bigger chamber pieces are a horn sonata for Ben Goldscheider, which will be premiered soon, at the end of this month, at the Hatfield House Chamber Music Festival, which I was thrilled to write. Ben's a stunning player and is commissioning a huge amount, actually, which is a great thing, both chamber music and concerti, which is wonderful. So that's been a lovely thing to write. I'm currently waiting also to hear the premiere of a string quintet, which is for the Piatti Quartet.
You're holding your neck. Suggests that on some level you are quite nervous about that particular work.
You know, I'm always nervous about every premiere. Nothing to do with the players, more to do with me.
Why particularly that one then? I mean, or have I read too much into that non-verbal communication?
No, it was quite challenging because I had to write, I was basically writing the horn starter at the same time as the quintet. Very different pieces, actually, obviously, in terms of the instrumentation, but also the character of the pieces are very different. But again, I was blessed with some amazing players. It's Piatti Quartet with Tim Lowe, wonderful cellist. So, I mean, you know, the music's in very safe hands. And
how do you navigate writing two works at the same time? My assumption is that the creative process demands a high level of awareness, and so therefore you're having to be quite responsive to what's going on at the moment. How do you marshal your time?
I find it...
Maybe you did.
Well, I do my best. I think I find it very hard to write two pieces at the same time. Always have done, but I had no option here because of the way the deadlines worked out. But they are completely different work, different instrumentations, so different, horn and piano, and then five strings, that I could navigate around that. Had it been a piece for, say, clarinet and piano and horn and piano, two different pieces, that would have been challenging, I think, very, very challenging, or two concerti, you know, that you're writing at the same time. But no, they're very different. In fact, I'd sketched out the string quintet before I started Ben's piece, so that was... I'm quite pleased I did that, actually. I wouldn't typically do that, but I knew there could be a crunch. So I think doing that gave me a sense. I knew, I kind of, you know, somewhere in my unconscious, it was still being written while I was doing his piece.
Yeah, if one was to pick over the score in an analytical way, are we likely to see or notice overlap?
No, actually, in those two pieces, no. I don't think there's any overlap. But one of the reasons being that with the horn sonata, it's got a little bit of a link to the Brahms horn trio. Do you know?
I don't know.
So, well, I didn't actually know it till quite recently, because I've always had a problem with Brahms.
Okay.
It's dreadful. And what got me out of my problem with Brahms was hearing Ben perform the horn trio. This was about 3 or 4 years ago. And I had heard it, but not since my teenage years. And I was just blown away by it. I thought, wow, this is a stunning piece. And it's kind of reintroduced me to a lot of the Brahms, which I had heard and thought I'd moved on from.
I'm sensing a trauma.
Well, you know, I realise what a... I'm not a convert to everything of Brahms, to be honest. I still struggle with some of it, but I've realised how extraordinary a lot of this music is, harmonically, structurally, on all sorts of levels.
I don't understand what your beef is. What's your beef with Brahms?
I think I struggled a bit with the piano music. I used to find a lot of it quite heavy, you know, a bit Germanic, perhaps, in the worst sense of the word, in that kind of chugging and a bit of that. And probably I still would struggle with some of that, but I mean... it's been a revelation to get to know for the first time, in some cases, some of the chamber music, but to also rediscover these pieces. Anyway, the trio, knowing that my sonata was going to be performed to get, you know, either side, one side of that trio with another piece the other side, was both daunting, but also, I thought, an opportunity.
And also, surely a requirement that if you're going to be sat in a concert listening to your work performed, then the very least that you can do is to at least listen to the Brahms.
Yeah, absolutely. And the slow movement of the Brahms creeps into my... I've quoted a small passage from the slow movement, and it actually comes in some of the other movements as a little kind of leitmotif. A very, very modest homage to a composer who I now think is wonderful, but who I did have some difficulties with. I mean, I'm not the first, you know, I think there are a few other composers who...
Are there any other composers that you have a similar beef with?
Really, of the great composers, I can't think of any that I don't love in some respect. I mean, again, I think very few people like everything, although there are composers whose work I like entirely, but no, Brahms was actually the only one I struggled with, and it's lovely at my, you know, now middle age to actually, as it were, discover or rediscover such a wonderful composer.
So we might hear a bit of Brahms in the there's a quote in
I think there's quite a recognisable quote. It's not completely kind of hidden away in the counterpoint or anything. But
and there is a string quintet as well.
There's a string quintet at the Wigmore. I've got a couple of concerts at Wigmore in October, 7th of October, one at 11 a.m, one at 3 p.m. So this new quintet is being programmed alongside the Schubert quintet, so the quintet for two cellos.
Would you like Schubert?
I adore Schubert. I adore Schubert. So it has been a bit traumatizing having something next to not only Schubert but one of his greatest chamber works. But anyway, that's how it goes. But anyway, it was specifically commissioned to go with the Schubert because actually there aren't that many quintets for that lineup. There's obviously a lot for two violas. but not that many for the two cello quintet lineup. So that's a different piece. It's a slightly shorter work, maybe 15 minutes. So I wanted to do what I hope is quite a succinct companion piece to that, to go before the Schubert. A four movement work. Each movement, I've tried to do really one thing in each movement, as it were, not to do something too kind of elaborate.
The other concert, the other Wigmore Hall concert, is all of your works. I mean, it's a bit of a fib celebration.
You could think of it as an overview of the last 10 years. So there's a work for saxophone and piano called Night Paths, fairly recent piece actually written a couple of years ago for Hugh Wiggin, superb saxophonist, with Noriko Ogawa, again an absolutely stunning pianist who I've had the pleasure of writing for before. They've recorded the piece now. My first string quartet from 2014, which was the first piece I wrote for the Piatti Quartet, with whom I've had a long and wonderful association, that's being performed. My cello sonata, which was for Guy Johnston, who I'm thrilled to say I'm writing a concerto for next year, but that's being performed. That was also a Hatfield House and Wigmore Commission, in fact, joint commission. So that's being done. And then a short elegy I wrote in 2016 after my teacher at Cornell University in America, Stephen Stuckey, passed away, and the pianist Gloria Cheng, who'd worked with Stuckey a good deal, asked a number of composers and friends of Steve's to write immediately after his death, to write very quickly a little piano miniature to you know, as an expression of our affection, I suppose, for him as a composer and as a person. So that's being played as well by Noriko, which I'm pleased.
What is that process like for you as a creative? You know, someone who was clearly important to you has died, and then you're asked to do that. I mean, is that a challenge?
In a way, it wasn't, because I mean, it affected me very much when he died. He's been a huge. You know, his music continues to be a huge influence. I think he's a genuinely great composer. He's not that well known here, but he's certainly in Eastern America. But he was also just a wonderful human being. So I was kind of in shock for the first week, I think, which is when I wrote the piece. So I didn't actually second guess what I was doing. I mean, Gloria Cheng wanted them very quickly, deliberately so, which was a good idea, really, just to capture the moment. And I just wrote it. I mean, it's a very simple piece. but it was relatively easy to write. I wrote it in a couple of days.
You say it was a shock. He died of brain cancer. You didn't know that he had tumour.
I had no idea how serious it was. In fact, I didn't. I had no idea. I knew he was having an operation, but that's all I knew. And that was a couple of months earlier, actually. He was diagnosed in November and died in February, if I'm not wrong.
Very swift.
Very, very swift. I think I've got that right. So, and he was young, I think 66, something like that. And you know, I mean, some of the last pieces he was writing, or certainly in the last decade of his life, were just, I think, some of his greatest works. Wonderful pieces, chamber music, larger scale pieces, concerto for orchestra. So it's a big loss. And I mean, I listen to his work a lot still, partly, of course, to remind me of him, but actually just, I think, objectively, just because I think it's such wonderful and enjoyable and unique music. So, I mean, it's remained with me.
What impact did he have on you as a teacher?
In terms of how I taught, would you say?
As a composer. Yes, I realise the question is slightly ambiguous.
No. He did actually also have an impact when I taught, because I suppose I did try to emulate to some extent how he taught me, because I think he was a very fine teacher. But he was pretty hands-off in some ways, as I guess you would be at that level. I mean, I was a postgraduate, and it was wasn't as specific as detailed as it might be at an undergraduate level, maybe. But I mean, he struggled to compose. It wasn't easy for him. And I would always walk into the lessons with my kind of head in my hands saying, oh, it's all rubbish, I can't do it.
He was very supporting and empowering.
He was, but I mean, I say that he wasn't insincere. I mean, he was a very sincere man. So when you came out, you felt that he had actually... He really meant what he said, and he said, you know, he'd look at a bar and say, "Oh God, I like that's pretty good, you know, you should keep that." And I said, "Oh, really? Is it? Oh, sure. That's."
I mean, if composing itself as a craft is very difficult for people like me to understand, the idea that one would teach composition is even more difficult to understand. I mean, what sort of how does one go about teaching? How did he teach you? He just like commented on bars and went, well, that's quite interesting, that's quite good.
Sometimes literally that, and it could make all the difference. It sounds crazy, but it actually could make all the difference. Because it's one of those seemingly vague comments that actually he would spot something quite specific that had potential. He'd say, oh, you know, that harmony's pretty good. And you go away and then think, well, actually, yeah, that harmony's quite nice. Maybe I can expand it, maybe I can draw on that. Or... he would say, well, you know, do you know this piece by, you know, Fauré, or do you know this piece that maybe I hadn't heard, you know, and that would then again trigger off responses that would feed into the piece I was working on, or he'd be able to locate works in the repertoire, because he knew the repertoire inside out, where specific problems had been solved, and those type of comments were very valuable. But I think it was his presence, I mean, and I know, because I've remained friends with some of his other former students, it was his presence as a human being that actually had a big impact. He was just a very wise, very kind, very supportive, and as I've said, very sincere person, and very giving.
And how do you emulate his teaching style?
When I was teaching at Purcell, I mean, my kind of first idea really with any teaching was to try to be encouraging, again, in a sincere way. Again, I would try to see the potential in a composer's work. I would say, you know, maybe this is a bit long here and you could shave a bit off there, or, you know, this harmony doesn't quite work here. But try to really pinpoint what was good and what could be built on. And so, yeah, in as much as I could... take from his teaching, that was the approach I took.
My assumption is that the role needs to be quite light touch, that one shouldn't really rush the student, shouldn't really rush the individual, and shouldn't really be looking out for, or maybe this is just a reflection of me, but shouldn't be looking out for the next composer, that you are merely sort of guiding somebody through a creative phase in their life. That's my assumption.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that's perfectly put, because, you know, certainly when I was teaching Purcell, not all of them would go on to be composers, and then they're often studying other, you know, studying piano.
Yeah, how old are Purcell?
Well, at Purcell, I think it was something like 9 to 18, roughly. I mean, I rarely taught under the age of 10, but, you know, typically I was teaching, say, 14 to 18. And sometimes, you know, they were just trying out composition, which is a perfectly valid thing to do. But it was quite clear when you were teaching someone for whom composing was going to be a really important part of their life, and you would then, you know, guide them in different ways. And I mean, I had some wonderful composers, some of whom I remain in touch with, and it's great to see their careers taking off, actually.
Do you see the appetite for new music having changed in the past 4 or 5 years?
I myself haven't. No, I haven't, actually. I mean, in fact, possibly, I think, I don't know about you, but one thing COVID did teach me was not to take what's going on. I mean, I'm lucky enough to live in London, but to not take for granted what's on the doorstep. So, I mean, I've started trying, when I can, to get to many more concerts and opera and cinema and so on, you know, and do more. But it seems to be pretty healthy at the moment, to my mind.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. You have 9 commissions this year. That's what I've counted from your biography. You had a look of fear on your face when I said that. You have got, I mean, I've counted them. There are nine. Did you not write this biography? Did somebody?
Couple of them, I think.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, I'm very fortunate to have a busy year next year, which is good. The big...
This feels like a big thing. They're all big things, obviously. Yeah, no, the Jelly Concerto,
Jelly Concerto for Guys is probably the largest... Well, is the largest scale of those. That should be performed, I think, next autumn. But that's a piece I'm really excited to write. Guys are, I think, one of the finest cellists around, so I'm very, very lucky. I mean, that's something I would say. I feel very blessed, both at Wigmore and also on the list that you've to be writing for stunning players. I'm lucky to be writing a sonatine for Noriko, actually, that's been commissioned, Noriko Ogawa, for a performance in Kawasaki, just outside Tokyo, next February. So that's a really lovely piece to be working on.
And also read in the biography was that the Clarinet Concerto was on the Sunday Times list of 100 best albums.
Yeah, that would. That, yes, that was a.
That was very pleased to hear. Because obviously, when I heard it, I remember saying to you, "Oh, this is good."
Yeah.
Which is obviously a great thing to say in an interview, but yeah.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, Mark did an amazing job with that, and I'm thrilled to say actually, for next year, I don't think this is on the list. I'm writing a clarinet quintet for Mark, and the Brodsky Quartet. So that will be at King's Place. I think it's next October.
I mean, I don't know what I'm doing next year. I barely know what I'm doing in the next 6 months. But how nice it is that you have things lined up.
I'm very, very fortunate. And I what I need to get a bit better at this year is just kind of scheduling time to not get into too much of a rush. And
do you have a tendency to say yes to everything? And then look at the diary and go, oh, no.
It can happen. I mean, when you're offered commissions by, these types of players, it's very hard not to say yes, because you think, my God, this is just the chance of a lifetime. So I do tend to take on what I can. And I remember Colin Matthews, who's a wonderful composer and friend and supporter over the last couple of decades, actually. But I remember him once saying that a good trick is to kind of whatever commission you're fortunate to get, to make it the one piece that you've always wanted to write. So I tried to remember that.
Is that what you tell them?
No.
Because if that is what you tell them, at some point somebody's going to go, yeah, he said that to me as well.
Yeah. No, yeah. I never tell them that. But I usually don't need to, because it often is actually one of the pieces I've always wanted to write. Certainly, all of these pieces on the list. But I mean, when Mark Vanderveel suggested the clarinet quintet, I thought, I've always wanted to write about that combination. Or I've wanted to write, we've been talking about that actually for a long time. So to have the opportunity to write for him is
when you reflect on your successes, what do you think has, what is the advice? What has contributed to those successes? Apart from the ability to write things that people want to hear, what do you think is central to carving out this kind of career?
That's a very difficult one. I guess, if I was to give advice to a much younger composer, I suppose it's just to keep going and to, try. I try to keep doing something new with each piece, not to kind of tread over old ground too much. It's sometimes very hard to avoid. To try to enjoy it, sometimes difficult to enjoy it, because it's demanding and you can become quite self-critical. But just to keep going, to keep in touch with people
My impression is that it is more difficult to be distinctive. It's more difficult to be distinctive and also not to create for an appetite. I mean, just because it's a far more commercially driven market now than perhaps 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
That's true. I suppose if there's one thing I don't think about so much now, it's any kind of conscious attempt to be original in that sense. I mean, you hope that at some point whatever you write will, if not original, but it's certainly hopefully, will be you. And I find that that's something I don't, yeah, I can't worry about, because it's just, it would be too paralyzing to do that. I mean, obviously you don't want to be consciously trying to kind of emulate other people at the expense of doing something authentic. But on the other hand, I hope that there's something, even if it's not cutting edge, but there's something that in the mix has something distinctive. I mean, I think it's very hard often for a creative artist to actually hear or see or read that in the case of an author. It's very difficult to be aware of actually who you are, objective. It's almost impossible. So it's sometimes very gratifying when someone will say, well, actually, it did sound like you. And you think, oh, God, thank God for that. I thought it sounded like everyone else. But
There's one quote that made me laugh, which was, I think it was from, it wasn't Classical Source. I can't remember who he was. He said, Phibbs is youngish. it seemed like such a backhanded compliment. But also, it was... I'm not going to flick through all of them, but it was a comment about, hang on, it's terribly important to get it right.
I only got the good reviews then.
I mean, I'll be honest, I flicked through it and thought, I don't see thoroughly good here, but maybe that's because I didn't write anything. nicely handled. Oh, it's something about being both modernist and accessible. I can't remember. Doesn't matter. But somebody had summed it up in a natty sentence, which is this sort of a musical language that is modern and accessible at the same time. So it would appear as though you have reached the magic point. You'd found the end of the rainbow. That was my impression from the quote.
Well, that's a very generous quote. I mean, I suppose you end up kind of trying to write ideally the music that you would want to kind of hear, listen to. But I go back to Steve, sorry to labour the point, but I do go back to Steve Stuckey, partly from what I said earlier about the fact that I listened to his music for pleasure, genuinely for pleasure. He was basically a modernist, really. I mean, he was a great Lutoslawski scholar, wrote the first book on Lutoslawski, but somehow he managed to assimilate or adapt that language, that essentially modernist language, into something more, I suppose, harmonically diverse, you could say, more triadic perhaps, although it certainly wasn't tonal, but there's a kind of lucidity within the harmony, which I love. And I remember him saying, actually, in a lesson, he had this, his ideal was to try to kind of carve out a harmonic vocabulary that could be all-inclusive, that could include this very, very cluster-driven music, could include entirely diatonic music. I distinctly remember him saying that, but there is something about his work where it doesn't feel like a compromise. That's not what it is. It's about somehow he's fused together different elements in a very meaningful and authentic way. It certainly clearly comes via Lutoslawski, but it's very much Steve Stuckey's own idiom. So, my aspiration, and at this point it certainly is only an aspiration, would be one day to feel that I'd somehow assimilated my influences into something that I could hopefully call my own.
My final question is about the Wigmore Hall concert with Night Paths, String Quartet, and... I can't remember what the other thing. Oh, the string quintet. String quintet is in there. Will you sit in the rehearsals for all of those and give direction, or has that moment passed for those previous works? Because I know that when you compose something, you need to be there in the rehearsals for the first performance.
That's right.
But once that's done, is it like, well, you just listen to the recordings, just get on with it yourselves?
Well,
or do you still feel the need to get involved?
I probably will go, well, certainly for Night Paths. Norika's not played that before, so I might sit in, I mean, she's stunning, it won't be difficult, but just to kind of, she's also not played the cello sonata, so she's playing in both of those. I'll see what they feel. Guy's played the sonata quite a number of times now, and is really, he's playing it phenomenally.
I love the hand movement.
Yeah. Well, I used to be a cellist, you see, so I don't know why I'm...
pretending it's really predictable. It's like, oh no, I must do the movement in case he doesn't know.
And the quartet number one, I mean, Piatti's have played that a good deal, so I won't go to that, but certainly the new quintet, I guess I will bid a rehearsal for that at some point.
Does it feel like a special treat, all of your works all in one event?
I feel incredibly privileged, and I'm very grateful for Wigmore for putting it on, and I feel truly blessed to have a dream team of players. I mean, it's just an extraordinary team of players doing my music. So, I mean, it's a phenomenal privilege, real, real privilege.
I mean, I don't imagine that Wigmore Hall would program something if they didn't think it would work. I think they know what they're doing.
In fact, were one of the commissioners for the cello sonata, so that's been done there. That's right, they were. And I've had the good fortune of writing for them before, so I mean, it's a wonderful venue. I still think one of the greatest chamber venues
isn't it in this country.
I
just feel calm when I go in there.
It's like going
into John Lewis.
Yes.
It has the same fit. I don't mean it's like John Lewis. As in it has the same, like... Oh.
It does actually. I never thought of it quite like that. Almost meditative feel when you're in the hall, but also the incredible fact that you can hear anything from any seat. You get an absolutely perfect acoustic wherever you are. I mean,
and if I'm not mistaken, it's air conditioned.
I believe it is. I don't know actually.
Well, maybe it's not now.
I'm not sure about that.
I just feel very comfortable, very calm.
I think it probably is air conditioned. No, absolutely. It has a lovely feel when you walk in. And so that's on the 7th, 7th of October, which is the Saturday. 11 a.m. is the first concert, and 3 p.m. the second one, which is the Schubert Quintet and mine.
And then after that, you just...
You've been listening to the Thoroughly Good Classical Music Podcast. My name is John Jacob. Follow Thoroughly Good on Twitter @ Thoroughly Good and on Instagram @ Thoroughly_Good.